I'm Lindsay Claiborne.
And I'm Mumu Shu, and you are listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Beyond the Microscope for our next episode. Today's guest is Molly Lindquist, and she is the founder of Consano.
Hi, Molly. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Lindsay. Hi, Mumu. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Who are you and what is Consano?
Excellent questions to start with. So as you mentioned, I started Consano, which is a nonprofit crowdfunding platform for medical research after my own diagnosis with breast cancer in 2011. So I kind of come from a finance, corporate strategy background and had this life-changing event, and it really reprioritize things in my life. And, you know, I came out of my experience really bummed out that my daughters now face a higher risk of having to face this at some point. And as a non-scientist, which I know is probably deceiving given the name of your podcast, I was well beyond the microscope, like way, like never really touched one since high school kind of positioning, so to speak. And I, you know, really knowing that I was not a scientist, you know, but knowing I had these other skills as well, decided that fundraising for research would become, you know, my mission. And that's really what I've done.
How did you get to that idea? And how hard was it to get it out of the idea phase?
Yeah, so the idea really started at a Memorial Day barbecue in 2012, and I was about 2 months out of my last chemo, so I had this lovely little buzz cut going on, and life was, you know, starting to look up, and I was feeling better, and, you know, we were having, I don't know, one or two beers potentially over our barbecue.
And, Only one or two? Come on.
Yeah, exactly. And so we were chatting with some friends who also graduated from Stanford with us. And I was talking about how I'd done all this due diligence of supporting research, but a lot of organizations didn't provide the transparency or the connection I was looking for. You know, and why wasn't there a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo for medical research where I could pick the project that mattered to me? And it was like this little light bulb moment. And that's really kind of how the journey started. To answer your second question, really a lot of the kind of early planning was just making sure, you know, did something like this exist? Because I certainly wasn't out to recreate the wheel. And, you know, would researchers be interested? It's certainly a different way of gaining funding. And, you know, would donors want this? Was I the only one? So it was really a lot of due diligence and a lot of positive feedback. And so we decided to proceed with developing the organization.
And you're still here.
And I'm still here on many levels. That makes me very, very happy. Well, I don't have all original body parts. However, the main part of me is still here, so I can't complain.
We should add, as a sort of full disclosure, you are my cousin-in-law. Your husband, Scott Finkelstein, is my cousin, and also he's a doctor. How much of an influence did Scott have in helping you get this off the ground and having the medical knowledge to go with your business knowledge?
Oh, Scott was indispensable. I mean, he basically connected us originally with people from his network. He did his med school and residency at UCSF. So we really started our due diligence by reaching out to people that he knew from that time that were actually doing research and saying, you know, is this interesting? Would this be useful? And, you know, the resounding feedback was, you know, funding is very, very challenging right now. The NIH budget continues to be cut. It's very difficult for particularly younger, earlier stage investigators to get funding. So the researchers were like, sign me up. This is a great, great way for us to get some additional funding. And so Scott really worked on developing our scientific advisory board. You know, one of our key differentiators from other crowdfunding sites is that, you know, every project that goes up on our site is vetted by our board. And so, you know, we really wanted to make sure that not only were projects legitimate and, you know, were actually coming from a credible source, but also that they really had the potential to lead to improvements in patient care. And so our scientific advisory board helps us do that. And Scott spearheads that. In addition to being, you know, an awesome caregiver during my cancer journey. And let's just say that guy's a keeper. And I'm not just saying that because he's your cousin.
Oh,
Lindsay.
Sure.
So just Diving in on the scientific advisory board that you mentioned, what sort of projects does the board sort of approve?
Yeah, so a wide variety of projects. You know, I started the site clearly because of my own breast cancer situation, i.e. the girls turned on me. And really, you know, when I started talking with patients in other, you know, areas touched by other diseases, it was kind of a universal truth that people were looking for this transparent connection, particularly if you weren't, you know, able to donate large sums of money. And so our scientific advisory board is comprised of, I think we're at 32 now, scientists, clinicians, and also patient advocates. And so when we get a project proposal in, that proposal goes to typically a handful of those people to get their thoughts. And a lot of times the biggest benefit that that group provides to the person submitting the project is feedback on, is the public going to understand this? You know, because again, going back to my non-scientific background, I'm usually the first screen. And if I, you know, don't understand eight of the, you know, 10 words in the first sentence, it's pretty clear that it's not a lay friendly abstract. But the scientific advisory board provides great feedback on that as well.
Have you noticed a big, I mean, I noticed this as a reporter, that there's the science folks and then there's the average person and there's a handful of people that are in the middle that are translating. Have you noticed that that's a big sort of gap that you have to bridge?
Yes. And I mean, it varies by researcher. Some are very, very good and very used to communicating their ideas to the non-scientific community, whether that's other foundations, you know, that's kind of typically the audience that would require a lay abstract. But yes, in many cases, I mean, these people are doing brilliant, really cutting edge work. And, you know, they don't necessarily know how to communicate that most effectively. So we help with that. And that, again, as a non-scientist, for me, I want to know what's going on. You know, for me, breast cancer research specifically is, you know, life and death to a certain extent. And, you know, knock on wood, I'm currently no evidence of disease, as I like to call it, my boyfriend Ned, and I'd like to keep my boyfriend Ned around as long as possible. You know, but I have lots of friends who literally, you know, are living with metastatic disease, and, you know, research is their hope. You know, that's really the only thing out there that, you know, could potentially extend their lives. And so,
jumping over to the entrepreneurial side, which is in itself a science of sorts. I mean, you've worked in corporate environments. How hard was it transitioning to the startup world and to be that kind of business, a small, you know, two, three person sort of idea to turn into a business versus, you know, working for corporate America?
Yeah, it is a roller coaster, you guys. I think any entrepreneur will tell you. I mean, the highs are so high, and it's so exciting to see an idea that you have kind of come alive. But the lows are also very low. And, you know, some days those things happen, you know, within hours of each other where you're like, this is the best day ever. I love this. And, you know, something else happens and you're like, why am I doing this? So it's kind of emotionally schizophrenic, so to speak. But overall, you know, it's really, for me as a mom as well, it's an amazing amount of flexibility that's a part of my day now. I get to do really cool things that I'm passionate about, but I can still go volunteer at my kid's school. So it's really a good combination for me, just in terms of lifestyle. But, you know, certainly very different from a stable corporate job where you know your role and, you know, you have your explicit goals and you're working toward them and you get your reviews. You know, this is a little more off the seat of your pants, so to speak.
Are there ever any research projects that are generated from overwhelming user or donor interest?
That is an excellent question. And that's something I'm really passionate about. I call that patient-driven research. And really, you know, the way that academia is set up right now, there's not a lot of opportunity for patients and people living, you know, with disease or people who have loved ones, you know, that they're caring for to have input early in the research process. I mean, historically, you know, a patient has been a subject and in a, you know, clinical trial, but never really a partner in the process. And so we actually had our first patient-driven initiative. We partnered with the Transverse Myelitis Association, and they went out to their patient population and said, you know, what are your research priorities? What matters to you? Is it, you know, finding, you know, genetic links that cause this disease? Is it quality of life? Is it slowing down the progression of, you know, neurological degeneration? You know, what matters to you? And so they did this survey, and with those results, we then called for proposals from the research community that aligned with those priorities. And we actually, I think it was about a month ago, fully funded that project. It was a $15,000 project out of the University of Texas. So it was really cool to see, you know, it's baby steps. That's certainly not, you know, 100% patient generated, but at least it's giving a voice to a population that often is overlooked. And the irony, and my friend Ronnie Zeiger, who is the co-founder of an organization called Smart Patients, he always says, patients are the micro experts. I mean, you're literally living with your disease 24/7 and have a lot of insights and perspective that's really largely untapped.
Do you feel like when you started this, you were filling a really empty space, or did you feel like you were sort of adding on to the popularity of stuff like Kiva and Indiegogo and things like that?
I think I felt like I was utilizing the tool that already existed. You know, it was working so well in so many other areas. And I was very also fortunate. Matt Flannery, who's one of the co-founders of Kiva, was a friend of mine from undergrad. So I could ask him a lot of questions. And it really became, you know, this mechanism is so useful for all of these things I'm looking for, the transparency, the, you know, being able to direct your donation to specific projects. And then, you know, this connection with researchers that you're typically not getting unless you're donating five and six figures, which I was not, although I do think that the Lindquist Cancer Center of Excellence does have a nice ring to it.
But let's just say several academic buildings, I believe.
Yes, exactly. But I am not, you know, in that position. And so, you know, but that being said, I still wanted to remain connected. And so this whole kind of mechanism really lent itself to that. So while I think we were filling a gap, I also think that we're providing a complementary way, you know, for donors who care about certain issues, you know, to kind of get down to the nitty gritty and really help define their priorities more easily. So both is the answer to my question, or to your question.
So just out of curiosity, are there characteristics of certain projects that work better than others in this type of format?
Mim was really asking because all of our friends are going to calling us up and say, can we get our project on this web platform?
Yes. I would also like to get funding this way as well.
Yes, totally. No, that's a great question. I think that it's less about the project and more about the researcher in terms of the success that we see. First and foremost, you know, this is definitely a very different way of raising funds. And there are some researchers that are not comfortable with that. You know, they're used to writing up a grant proposal, you know, going before the grant review committee and getting that feedback. Whereas, you know, with crowdfunding, you're pitching yourself to the public, which can be kind of a scary thing on a variety of levels. One, you know, just that's not typically the audience you're communicating to. You know, some researchers are concerned about having, you know, their research ideas out there because we live in kind of an incentive system where you think publish or perish and you want to keep your information close to you. But what we're finding is, you know, given funding is so challenging, people are willing to really take a risk and, you know, try this out. And so our most successful projects have come from researchers who are willing to reach out, you know, to their own friends and family and really rally that support. And another component too is a grateful patient population. So often it's easier for researchers who are also clinicians to raise funds because, you know, they're actually having a direct impact on a patient's life, you know, and I can just speak for myself personally. I, you know, wanted to just hug my doctors every time, you know, I'd go through a milestone because that was the person getting me through it. You know, Dr. Johnson took out the cancer, like I will love her forever. And Dr. O'Brien created my new chest and I love her. I mean, you know, it's all this very, I call it an attitude of gratitude where, you know, a lot of times we don't know how can we, I can never pay them back. I mean, they literally took cancer out of my body, but maybe I can help, you know, with their research pursuits or, you know, do something small in that way. And we're finding that a lot of our donations come from that grateful patient population who rallies their friends and family, who also are looking for a way to show support to that person. So it's kind of I would say it really is more dependent on the researcher than the actual research project.
Do you find this is going to sound very like technical, but is that the projects that do well are the ones that are quote unquote SEO friendly, that are search engine friendly, you know, breast cancer, pancreatic cancer, those keywords that sort of pop up in social conversations that are far more successful than ones that may seem more obscure, but maybe more valuable?
No, you know, I think at this point, we're not big enough really that, you know, random traffic being driven to a project is really shifting donation patterns. Again, most of the traffic is really organically generated from the researcher. So, you know, very few people are typing in breast cancer and we're not going to pop up. You know, those keywords are very valuable. So we haven't hit the point where the, you know, kind of the SEO component is really hugely impactful. That being said, we have one project from Dr. Richard White out of Memorial Sloan Kettering that he entitled "Why Does Cancer Kill You?" And we do get a lot of traffic coming to that, you know, because people are literally typing that exact phrase into their search engine.
As depressing as that sounds.
Yeah, I was going to say, as awful as that is. And every now and then, too, I'll you know, check our Google Analytics and I'll see some of these really just heartbreaking, you know, searches, particularly, I mean, it always gets me, again, I think, from the mom perspective, you know, for pediatric cancer. So it's definitely, cancer is a big, ugly beast.
So now that you've talked to us and you're going to become even more famous, you know, in this podcast, let's say we have some friends of ours or people who listen that want to get their project in your registry of things. What's the process?
Yeah.
Is it simple? Is it complicated? Do you have to know someone? How's it work?
Yeah. Well, you have to know me very, very well. And we've
Lindsay
made it
look
as
up here.
I have an inside track.
Yes, exactly. We've made it very complicated. No, you know, our whole goal with this was to make it easy for researchers. Because again, as a patient, I want you researchers in the lab, my friends. I want you finding better treatments. I want you curing things. I don't want you writing grant applications, which is, you know, a huge percentage of a researcher's time. In fact, I was shocked to find how much time they spend doing that. So really, if people are interested in listing a project, they can just email the info@consano.org account. And with, you know, a short paragraph on their research area and then a budget goal. And at this point, you know, our kind of sweet spot for fundraising is on the smaller end. So it's typically better for seed funding, or if a researcher has a larger project that they want to break off a smaller piece, you know, we're typically raising anywhere from, you know, 10 to 20,000, which, as you guys know, I mean, to run a clinical trial, it's millions of dollars. So we're not quite there yet. We're not replacing NIH R01 grants yet, but as this gets popular, you guys, once this podcast airs, yeah, I know we're just going to blow up. So I am hopeful that it becomes a really meaningful part of the research funding process.
So going back to the seed money, what kind of work can be done with, you know, a total of about 10,000, 20,000? Just coming from my field, we get small grants in the area of 50K, 100K, mm-hmm. and that's kind of sort of seed starting money for us.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think that the way that we've set up the kind of the format of the project pages is to have researchers break out exactly what they're using the money for. So it really varies. Our first fully funded project raised just $6,000, a very small amount. However, the researcher, she needed to buy mRNA assay kits, and two of them cost $7,000. And so it was a very discreet thing that she was looking to do. And so it made a lot of sense. We've had, you know, other kind of pieces of equipment, whether that's a one of our rhabdomyosarcoma researchers bought, you know, basically an attachment for his microscope to film video so that they can watch cells metastasizing and see, you know, where they were going and why they were doing that. And then there's also just, you know, general supplies, and we provide step goals as well. So the way that Consano is set up is that researchers get to keep whatever they raise. So, you know, that's kind of a controversial crowdfunding move because, you know, Kickstarter, for instance, it's all or nothing. You know, you have to raise the entire amount. So, you know, we debated for a long time, do we do that? Do we make it more flexible? And, you know, in getting feedback from our donors, most people, you know, they're getting their tax deduction, they're supporting research that really matters to them. As long as they know the money can still be utilized, even if the total target isn't hit, they're happy to have that connection. And so, you know, even if a researcher's raising $1,000 of their goal, they still have earmarked it for a certain use.
So this is getting very technical, but this money that is given to researchers, is there any overhead associated with that for to the university, to the hospital?
That's also a really important question, and one that, you know, we were deciding the framework of how the funding would flow through. The way that Consano works is that each donation, you know, each donor donates to a project, those donations are aggregated, and then a gift check is cut to typically the foundation or development office within the academic institution. So because it's a gift, there's usually a small fee for gift processing, but overhead is not taken out. So that's a huge difference because many institutions, take a large chunk. That being said, however, I think that in talking with a lot of the research administrations, it's tricky because, you know, overhead gets a bad rap and, oh, you're taking all this money. However, often overhead from a really well-funded, you know, department or area like breast cancer, for instance, is, you know, being used to support other departments that might not, you know, receive as much funding. So, you know, it's tricky. It's not clear cut.
Did you find there were more hurdles than you expected in working this out, or was it, I mean, because there are all these other factors, right? You can't just talk to a scientist and say, here, let's give you money. I mean, there's all these other...
Although they would love that if I did do that.
Slash an envelope under the table.
Totally. Here's a check for $1 million.
No one will ever know.
Yeah. You know, I think we were very, very... deliberate in really trying to hash out as many of those issues in the beginning by bringing a lot of those stakeholders into the conversation. So, you know, before we created the website, we talked to tons of researchers to get their perspective on, you know, what's the easiest process for them? How can they leverage, you know, other grants that they're writing, things like that. We talked to the development offices who aren't typically structured, particularly for younger investigators who might not have their own lab account set up. You know, how do we make it easy for the development offices so that we're not creating all this extra work? And so we talked to a lot of people and really tried to integrate as many of those learnings into the way that we work as possible. And because we're, you know, small and lean and flexible, we can also, you know, we can work when issues come up pretty quickly to resolve them. So yes, I mean, there were definitely a lot of logistical things to think about, but it's really actually been a lot of fun. I got to use my Excel again, which I hadn't done for several years.
True sign,
I mean,
you know. I'm a data nerd right there.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned health technology and innovation, that is a huge field. You have Apple Health and you've got Google Health and the Health Kit stuff. Are you, I mean, is it something that all of a sudden all these startups and companies, I mean, you're almost ahead of the curve. I mean, I know you're not building an app or like a, you know, fitness tracker, but like, is there a whole new business or a whole new sort of corporate or, you know, niche that's popping up around this kind of thing?
Oh, big time. I mean, I was just down, it was 2 weeks ago in San Francisco at the Rock Health Digital CEO Summit. And that's all, you know, healthcare startups that are taking kind of their own perspective or identifying their own problem and, you know, trying to address it. I mean, there's huge, huge opportunity in that space in general. And investors are starting to move there as well, which is exciting to see.
Will that help you in any form? Or are you the old group of the pack there?
Well, given we're more philanthropic, if all of those small companies make a lot of money and then like to make charitable donations, that will positively impact us.
Stand up there waving your sign going,
exactly. Hey, guys.
Need that tax
break,
right?
Don't forget about us. Exactly. No, I mean, I think also just, you know, as better tools are developed, you know, the research techniques might change. I think it will definitely, will be a part of all of that. Maybe not directly, but yeah, it's really exciting to watch. I mean, there's very cool stuff.
Just as an aside, did the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge do anything traffic-wise or interest-wise in ALS?
The Ice Bucket Challenge has now become that thing that every organization wants to recreate because it was such a huge impact. And I don't have the stats in front of me, but I mean, it raised millions and millions of dollars. It, you know, spread awareness. You had celebrities and, you know, everyone and their brother was doing the Ice Bucket Challenge. And I think that that's such an awesome form of awareness. And I know that there are a lot of, you know, rare diseases, for instance, that are like, oh, you know, here's what we're living with. You know, it was a phenomenon. I don't even really know what to say about it, except that, I mean, I participated. It was not pleasant. And, you know, the idea behind it was really that, you know, that feel of the freezing water is a lot of the sensation that someone with ALS has, you know, as their nerves are degenerating. And I don't know if that message got lost, but, you know, I think that anytime you can get something to go viral like that, you know, more power to you. If you guys happen to unlock the key to virality as you do this podcast, will you please loop me in?
Yeah, because we'd like to know that also.
That would be fantastic to know.
Well, we do have an upcoming guest who's actually going to be talking about viruses, so maybe.
maybe we'll get
something
from it.
I don't know if that's the virality you were going for.
right. Yes, that's my big joke is like, you know, I want Consano to spread like a disease. I'm like, wait a minute,
I want Consano to spread like a curable disease. There we go.
Yeah, exactly. Totally.
All right, Molly, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really fun, and it's really exciting to see what you guys are working on and how it's progressing.
Thank you guys so much for having me and letting me share my cancer story. Hopefully everyone at home has taken out their tissues and can wipe away their tears knowing, you know, so far it's a happy ending.
We didn't let you get too like sappy on us though.
That's true. You did a good job with that, because I do like to flip out that cancer card. So you got to keep me under control.
Oh man. Well, thank you, Molly. I really appreciate it.
Thank you guys.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Mumu Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.